Hello and welcome to The Week in 60 Minutes, brought to you by Spectator TV and broadcast on Thursday, April the 29th. I'm Fraser Nelson, standing in for Andrew Neil. On this week's show, we're going to be covering the latest in the Downing Street psychodrama. Who's going to come out on top? Boris, Dom, or perhaps Carrie? Our political editor, James Forsyth, and Katie Balls will give us the latest. Then Douglas Murray and Kate Andrews will discuss whether Britain really needs a First Lady. Then we'll turn on to the far trickier question, not who leaked the second lockdown, but whether that lockdown was implemented on a false premise. Now we're going to be looking at the COVID in India question and then ask if Britain should be donating vaccines as well as ventilators. And then finally, looking at cyber warfare, we're going to be talking to Sir Richard Dearlove, the former head of MI6, about the new tools headed by Russia and China and how much we should worry. All that to come in the next hour. But before we get going, we've got a new app which you can get from the App Store or on Android. It's got all of the Spectator podcasts, the blogs, the magazines, and for a special introductory offer, we're offering 3 months absolutely free, full digital access. The offer ends at midnight on Sunday, so you can avail yourself of it by going to spectator.co.uk/TV offer. And as ever, a special thank you to Charles Stanley, one of the UK's leading wealth management firms and sponsor of Spectator TV. Without their sponsorship, we would have no show to show you. They're one of the oldest companies on the London Stock Exchange. The Spectator is the oldest magazine in the world. We're delighted to be partners with Charles Stanley. Okay, to business. This week's psychodrama is depicted in the front cover of this week's magazine. We had a pretty tricky job. How do you sum up everything in all of its elements? Well, you can see what we've done here. We've got Boris in bed not wanting to wake up because of the nightmares surrounding him. Dominic Cummings, Nicola Sturgeon on one side, a COP26 bunny at the end of the bed, a Dyson fan. But when he opens his eyes, he sees Carrie Simmons, his fiancée, with a very long bill. A bill whose financing is now the subject of an electoral commission inquiry. James Forsyth, who writes our cover piece this week, says that of all the allegations facing Boris right now, and there are quite a few of them, the wallpaper gate, as it's becoming known, is the most potent. He joins me now along with Katie Balls. James, is this really the most serious charge levelled at Boris Johnson after the year that Britain's just had?
The question about the Downing Street flat and its redecoration is different because this involves money and therefore there are documents and a trail of what happened. And the Electoral Commission have now launched an investigation into it, and that is going to reveal precisely how it was funded. And I think for that reason, it is of a separate order to the other claims against him.
Right. Katie, can you tell us what they're thinking in number 10 of this? I mean, on one level, you could say, look, of all the things that have gotten wrong in Britain in the last year, the question of who paid for the wallpaper at number 10 is pretty low down voters' priorities, even though it might set the Westminster Village aflutter.
Yeah, I think the official line, or the line that you hear the most if you ask this question, particularly as in number 10, is that no one cares about this. This is a bubble story, and it shows yet again how perhaps the lobby, perhaps the opposition, depending which angle you're going on, are tripping themselves up on something which isn't really of that much interest to the average person on the street. However, I think that if you scratch the surface a little bit more, I do not think there are particular nerves that this is going to change how the party performs in the local elections. They're not picking that up from campaigners, from ministers who are going out there, from the party chairman. But it is very clear to everyone in government that the Prime Minister is incredibly rattled by the recent stories, particularly the flat refurbishment, but also other stories regarding his text messages that have been made public. And it's really getting to him. At Prime Minister's questions this week, Boris Johnson seemed very angry indeed. Even though Keir Starmer didn't manage to land, I suppose, fatal blows in that exchange, by the end, the Prime Minister just appeared to be shouting about various things that weren't particularly connected. And I think it is having an impact because we're constantly told, oh, well, no, the government's focused on the pandemic. The government is focused on the vaccine rollout. It's not focused on this. But the actions and the behaviour of the Prime Minister suggest that despite all that talk, his mind is on this row.
But James, this is about far more than wallpaper. We all know that. It's about honesty. It's about integrity. It's about transparency. And surely the danger facing Boris Johnson is that there are a great many people in Parliament and certainly outside it who thinks he isn't particularly honest or transparent, and that he simply has been rumbled and is displaying a fundamental character flaw that makes him unfit for office. So this might be the thread which, if you pull it, might unravel his whole premiership.
So I think the question here is, I mean, everyone knew that Boris Johnson is a bit chaotic, a bit disorganised. And I think if that comes out in the inquiry and that it's a late registration or this or that, then I think that is kind of priced in with voters. But if it comes out and it looks venal, I think that would be very different and would draw a very different reaction from people. I think his defence will be, look, you know, there's no taxpayer money involved beyond the £30,000 that all prime ministers are offered each year for the upkeep of the flat. But I think if it comes out and the whole paper trail looks very awkward and embarrassing, then I think that could be difficult. I think this is a fascinating moment because, as Katie said, we've got a big set of elections coming up next week, and the Tories are optimistic about how they will do. There's even talk that they might win the Hartlepool by-election, which would suggest that, you know, that there is still, that Keir Starmer hasn't managed to stop the bleeding in the red wall for Labour. But there is no doubt that the biggest threat to this political realignment in England at the moment is the fact that its two principal architects, Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings, have fallen out in this spectacular fashion. And they are now in what seems quite close to all-out war. And Boris Johnson, as the elected politician, is the one with far more to lose.
Katie, what will happen next in this all-out war? Do we imagine that Dominic Cummings is sitting there with a lot more ammunition, a lot more quotes that Boris Johnson might have issued behind closed doors in moments of anger? Because certainly the one we had this week, the let bodies pile high rather than implement a third lockdown, that certainly seems to have got quite wide resonance. And that's the sort of thing that voters might not forgive him for. Wallpaper? Perhaps, who cares? But certainly an attitude of that he was prepared to tolerate higher casualties because out of some ideological aversion to lockdowns, that is a far more potent accusation than one people might well remember.
Yes, and I think that when we look at why we're currently in this psychodrama or the latest round of it, is because Boris Johnson made the decision to brief to the papers that he blamed Dominic Cummings for a series of leaks. And it was that drip-drip effect of, it's not just the flat, it's not just one comment, it's not just one set of messages between him and a world leader or an entrepreneur on ventilators. It's the fact that you never quite know when it's coming that I think has really worn the Prime Minister down. And if you speak to allies of Dominic Cummings, A, they will say, well, how do you know every leak is Dominic Cummings? How do you know any leak is? So there is not an acceptance that it is. But there's also a sense that there is plenty more where that came from. Dominic Cummings was ultimately at the top of this government, some would say running it, depending who you speak to, for some time, and therefore had access to everything. Given this row is getting more toxic by the day, I think you could feasibly see more negative stories. I also think the fact that at the moment Dominic Cummings is blamed for every story, particularly in certain papers, gives others cover to come out with stories. But I think the date that should really worry the Prime Minister, and does, is the 26th of May, which is when we are currently expecting Dominic Cummings to appear before the COVID inquiry by the Science and Health Committees into the government's pandemic response. And this is one where Dominic Cummings in the past has not shown that he particularly loves parliamentary inquiries. He was once found to be in contempt of Parliament for skipping one on fake news. When he did appear in one during the EU referendum, he started the session by saying, just FYI, I've got a meeting at 4, so I can't stay later than that, which landed very badly. But this time around, in his blog, he's saying, I'll take all the time in the world, I'll answer any questions you want, I'll show you any messages in relation to it. I don't think that's because Dominic Cummings suddenly loves Commons inquiries. I think that's because he has a lot he wants to say. And the problem for Boris Johnson is, yes, we have anonymous briefings, but it's not too long before Cummings wants to actually go on the record.
So James, in your cover story this week, you talk about meeting Andy Street, who's running for re-election as West Midlands Mayor. You spent some time with him. Your impression is that electorally things are going reasonably well for the Tories in the north of England. And if they can prove that the Tory effect has outlasted Brexit, has outlasted Jeremy Corbyn, then Boris Johnson, he might not quite have a get-out-of-jail-free card, but your analysis is that he will be able to say to his party, look, Yes, my personal life is chaotic. Yes, I let my fiancé run up the mother of all bills for redecoration, but I can still win elections, and therefore you should still back me.
Boris Johnson's relationship with his parliamentary party is transactional. Lots of Tory MPs had doubts about him in 2019, but they still voted for him as leader because they thought he was the only person who could get the party out of a hole that it was in. He's a winner, he's a campaigner. And I mean, the big question after the 2019 general election, when the Tories won that majority, was this a one-off? That Tory electoral coalition was kind of glued together by get Brexit done and fear of Jeremy Corbyn. Remove those two elements and would it all fall apart? And I think right now it doesn't look like it is, because one of the things Andy Street said to me is, you know, Brexit just simply doesn't come up on the doorstep at all now. Yet, you know, the Tories still think they are in the good shot of holding the West Midlands mayoralty. I think that suggests that this realignment is about more than just Brexit. I also think that the vaccine rollout is really helping the Tories. There's no doubt about that. If you look at the approval of the government's handling of coronavirus, it's now up to 59%. That's up from 30% last September. And, you know, 59% is where it was in April last year when we were still in the first lockdown. So I think the public's view has become much more positive. And I was very struck, and this I think has got to be the Tories' great hope, for a set of election results that enable Boris Johnson to try and change the conversation is, you know, I asked someone in the West Midlands and said, you know, so who are you voting for? And they said, well, I've had my jab, as if that was an answer to my question. And I think Boris Johnson's hope will be a good set of election results will enable him to change the conversation. Now, I think we should caveat that with the fact that this Electoral Commission inquiry, I suspect, will take time. And when it comes, it could actually come at a much more politically inconvenient time for Boris Johnson. But I think the crucial thing to focus on is you know, that Boris Johnson's strength and weakness, in a way, is just how transactional his relationship with his parliamentary party is. As long as the Tories look like they are winning, then I think Tory MPs will be prepared to stick with him.
Katie, in your piece for the magazine this week, you look at the sheer rate of churn in 10 Downing Street, how very few of those who walked in there with Boris Johnson are still there. And in some ways, the most senior communications official is his fiancée, Carrie Symons. For a long time, he has tried to keep her out of the news. He hates it when she gets mentioned. But right now, not only is she on the cover of The Spectator, but she's right at the centre of his story, at the centre of the Electoral Commission's investigation. So do you think from now on, Carrie Symons is going to be very much a figure in the story of the Boris Johnson government?
I think that is true. I think that she is becoming a figure of increasing importance. I think perhaps of importance for some time. But as you say, I think what's changed is it's much harder now for Downing Street to say this person is irrelevant. They are not, as I've said, they are a private individual. Yes, they are a private individual. But the fact is they are an active player in what is a scandal, which is going to run on for some weeks and months to come involving this flat. Now, that means that I think we're going to keep seeing that person being written about. And then I think when it goes to number 10 staff, we have had a situation where, as you touch on, it's not just Dominic Cummings, other vote lead people such as Lee Kane. We've also had James Slack, not a factional figure, who was briefly director of communications, highly respected. You've had Allegra Stratton, who was supposed to be the Prime Minister's spokesperson, who also has been moved to a different role. And I think that these are just a handful, but there's more where that came from. And it is creating a sense of churn, but also we know this Prime Minister takes a long time to trust people. And I suspect the events of the past week or two, perhaps the past few months, will not have helped with his sense of trusting easily. And that means who in that building will he actually listen to, will he confide in? The cast list is getting smaller and smaller, and that means Carrie Symons is of increasing importance.
Katie and James, thanks very much. Well, the role of Carrie Symons is looked at by Douglas Murray in his column for this week's magazine. He says that she's increasingly becoming like an office for the First Lady. Do we necessarily want to go down an American route? He joins me now, along with Kate Andrews, our economics editor, who's got a bit more sympathy for the idea. But Douglas, first of all, I mean, surely what we need is a recognition that things have moved on, that of course politicians' spouses are going to be important to them, and Carrie Symons is always going to be influential to Boris Johnson. Is it so bad to simply acknowledge the fact?
Well, I suggest at the beginning of my piece that it's not a very good arrangement in America. that having an office in the East Wing of the White House, which is the office of the First Lady, isn't an entirely comfortable fit in the US. It makes American politics less like a democracy, more like a court, in which you don't only have the First Lady, or perhaps at some point in the future the First Husband, but all the encumbrances of the First's children and much more. You have First Ladies proposing legislation. You had this in the 1990s with Hillary Clinton, an exceptionally uncomfortable moment when the spouse of a president is proposing legislation for the country. Nobody elected her at that point. They did subsequently. Nobody elected her at that point. And there's something extremely uncomfortable about this, that somebody should effectively get power simply by the fact that some decades earlier they were fortunate enough or otherwise to marry somebody who ended up becoming the president.
Right, but not everybody can be a sort of silent Dennis Thatcher. I mean, you don't need to give Carrie Simmons legislative powers, but surely a bit more formal support would have avoided this mess in the first place. And what we're surely seeing is problems arising from a lack of support given to the office of the Prime Minister's spouse, or the lack of
office. Well, she has had formal support. She has had a £100,000 a year director of communications paid for, based in Downing Street, to give her advice. That's an extraordinary situation to be in. I don't believe that Dennis Thatcher ever benefited from any such munificence. In recent decades, in fact, throughout history, the spouses of prime ministers in the United Kingdom have actually tried to audition to show they do not have influence. Dennis Thatcher, as you referred to, very successfully portrayed himself as a sort of silly old buffoon, precisely to go under the radar in this way. Sherry Blair, who is, of course, an extremely distinguished and successful barrister in her own right, was constantly having to demonstrate during her husband's time in Downing Street that she was not mixing up her professional and her personal life. And I suggest that is quite as it should be. We do not have first ladies or first gentlemen. We have not had first girlfriends before, and it is very desirable for our country that that remains the case.
Kate Andrews, perhaps Britain then is a model that America should follow and not vice versa.
Well, Douglas is completely right to point to the tension that the role has created historically in the United States. When George Washington's wife, Martha Washington, was first dubbed Lady Washington, people felt very uncomfortable about this. It rank of nobility, and that was exactly what America had just fought to get itself rid of. So the title itself has actually been contentious, really going back all the way in American history. But I would argue that perhaps it's the best of a bunch of bad options, because in reality, I think it's true, certainly true in America, but becoming increasingly true in the UK, you have to have something to do if you are in one of these positions. We no longer live in a society where women are just automatically going to do the domestic job. And in America, we have not yet had a female president, so it's always been a woman who's been in this supportive role. And I think that's become more formalized and possibly in a positive way. Douglas mentions Hillary Care there, and I think it's almost the exception that proves the rule. Hillary Care was a disaster. It was seen as a huge overreach of the First Lady when Bill Clinton appointed her to be chair of that health reform task force, and it completely failed. It never properly got off the ground, and I think a large part in that was a feeling that was not the role of an unelected, far less accountable person to be taking on. If the president wants to reform healthcare, that's one thing. But if their spouse wants to do it, that's quite another. The other initiatives that we've seen from first ladies in recent years are indeed fundamentally rooted in politics, but they tend to be something that's more on the sideline that feeds into the president's agenda. And at the end of the day, the president, of course, is still responsible. And I think in 2021, if you are a man or a woman in the US or the UK supporting the president or prime minister, there's a very real chance that you've stepped away from your own career. We saw that with Michelle Obama. We saw that with Hillary Clinton. And here in the UK, you know, Carrie Simons was doing her own job. She was came up through the ranks of the Conservative Party, was working for Bloomberg. She's somebody who's going to want to be involved in some capacity. Formalizing that, I think, is a much better option than what we've seen over the past few months, where because it is completely informal, it gets very, very messy, but also you can't hold her or anybody else to account in the same way you could if all of this were formally on the record.
May I just ask, though, Kate, if that's your contention, how could this situation be improved? How could the first girlfriend be more accountable if she had a larger office with a bigger spend? How would we hold her accountable?
Well, the idea is that what she would be doing wouldn't be behind the scenes anymore. It would be public, and everybody would be able to say, is this feeding into the Prime Minister's agenda? Does this feel right? Is this what the Prime Minister was elected to do, and this sideline project has been given to his fiancé? I think you would have more accountability there, but I think one of the problems...
But how?
Well, it would be formalized. What her job was supposed to be would be on the record. And then if she were doing things that weren't in her remit in that position, I think it would be much more easily scrutinized and we'd be able to call it out much faster. I mean, one of the problems we've had for months now is that when her name is brought into this, you have a lot of people who say she shouldn't be brought into this at all. That's sexist. That's problematic. She has nothing to do with what happens in Downing Street. And we should stop kidding ourselves. Of course, she has plenty to do with what's happening in Downing Street. And in America, it's far from a perfect system. I completely agree with you, Douglas. And it may well cost some taxpayer money. But at least we're not pretending that the situation isn't what it is. It's on the record, it's formalized, and you can hold people accountable. You can scrutinize it. At the moment, I almost think it's too easy to say she's not involved. We should create a system in which we can talk about her involvement and, you know, be critical of it if necessary.
Okay, but can I ask a brass tacks question in this situation? Let's take an example I give in the piece. 2020, there is a proposed badger cull because farmers and others in the UK have a particular problem with badgers. Carrie Symons apparently persuades her boyfriend, her fiancé, the Prime Minister, that the cull should be stopped, and he does stop the cull. Now, that's against a lot of expert advice, and I'm told that one of the communities that suffered from this decision was the hedgehog community. Now, as it currently stands, there is no accountability for Carrie Symons for this decision. But I do not see, and I'm yet to be persuaded, that were there a formal office of the first girlfriend in Downing Street, there would be any more accountability. What would we do? You can't chuck her out. You can't say to the Prime Minister, I'm sorry, you've got to get a different first girlfriend. You've got to fire this one. He may want to at some point, but we can't tell him to do that. It's not in our remit as voters. In the United Kingdom, if you want political power, you've got to stand before the electorate and offer yourself before the electorate. There is no other way. That is one of the principles of British democracy. It was one of the principles that drove our vote to leave the European Union, accountability of the elected to the electorate. And the proposition that on top of the elected, you get spouses and in time children, and in America we currently seem to have a sort of informal position of the niece of the vice president. I suggest if people want power in Britain, there's only one way to get it and to wield it, which is to first put yourself before the public and see whether they like you or not.
Douglas, I don't disagree with your broad assessment, but I think you're almost asking a different question, which is whether or not the Prime Minister, who is the leader, with whom the buck ultimately stops, is being influenced by the right people under the right circumstances. And that is really a question for him, because he shouldn't allow himself to be swayed, especially if the evidence isn't in favor of a decision that he's making. But I think you can tackle that and also separately say that in 2021, it might make sense to formalize these processes more so that people have something to do, more to do, when they're in Downing Street and often have to give up what they were doing before. But also, crucially, so if they step out of that remit, it's much easier for the media to come in and scrutinize that, which I think has actually been very, very difficult, possibly up until the past week, over the past few months.
Douglas Murray and Kate Andrews, thanks very much indeed. Now, one thing the row is so far missing is what people have been talking about who leaked the second lockdown. But another question has been enlivening the scientific community. Was the second lockdown necessary? In fact, were any of the lockdowns necessary to force infections into reverse? Every single one of these lockdowns was justified on the grounds that infections were rising quickly. But if you have a look at the data coming out now, it seems as if that wasn't the case after all. I'm joined now by Professor Simon Wood at Edinburgh University, who recently completed a study into this, and by Professor Tim Spector from King's, whose Zoe app has been collecting all kinds of COVID information, including infection levels, when they peaked, and when they started to go down. And Professor Wood, can I start with you? Tell us a little bit about how you have reconstructed the story of our recent COVID past and what you found when you did so.
Okay, so what I did was to look at the data on the number of deaths daily from COVID, and then simply tried to back calculate to when those people must have been infected on the basis of the published information on the distribution of time from infection to death. So how variable that is. And there are several reasonable papers on that, and I tried to take into account the uncertainty associated with it. So you can do that kind of backcasting, if you like, and work out when people were infected who then sadly later died. And if you did that in the first wave or at the second or third lockdown, what you tend to see is that it appears that that cases were coming down somewhat before the full lockdown was called. And indeed, if you then try and compute the R number associated with that incidence rate, that also appears to be below one before lockdown. And the reason for looking at deaths is because deaths really are, you know, what they say they are, that you don't have this problem of somehow working from an unrepresentative sample. The deaths are pretty much a census of what happened. And also with that that duration information, there's reasonably good information available. And so those do seem to be two reasonably good sources of information with which to try and infer what was going on.
Right. Tim Spector, your Zoe app has been collecting COVID infections data in real time. Does that sound right to you, what Professor Wood has just outlined?
Well, we started collecting data on about the 24th of March last year. And so we weren't really in a position to mark the exact timing of the first wave.
But on the second wave, you had quite a lot of data by then.
The second wave we did, and there's no doubt that according to our data, it had already started, we'd passed the peak before lockdown. So it was already going down when the official lockdown came into play. And on the third lockdown, it really coincided, depending on exactly where you put it, but I think most of us looking at it thought the peak had already passed by the time of the third lockdown. So I think it would support Simon's view that based on the death rates, you know, looking at the incidence rates, the new cases, the numbers were already past their peak when the official lockdown came in. Although, of course, people might have reacted differently on the build-up to those things. So the exact timing isn't clear. But certainly, it does raise a big question mark over this.
Right. Now, Professor Wood, let's look at the second lockdown. That's the one at the focus of the political discussion right now. If your studies show that cases were not rising when the second lockdown was introduced, as the politicians had thought at the time, that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. What would have forced infections down if not lockdown?
Well, I think there were a lot of other things going on. We had this tier system in place. That's one thing. So there was active management. It's not as if it's all, you know, complete lockdown or nothing at all. There was a lot in place. But of course, it's a slow process, this. It takes a long time to turn the epidemic around. And you kind of have to wait for your measures to be effective. I think that's one aspect. I think the other aspect, of course, is that people really do react to rising deaths. You see the deaths rising and suddenly you start thinking again, oh, this is a serious business. And I think people's behaviour probably changes in relation to that. But of course, I can't prove that that's what's happened.
Right.
But, you know, there's a lot going on in addition to the absolute full lockdown, I think. And that's the key thing.
Right. And Tim Spector, this is a hugely important issue, of course. It relates to our understanding of the so-called non-pharmaceutical interventions, the NPIs, and what drives down COVID, whether it is government policy or whether it's people's behaviour. I guess Professor Wood is saying that when people read about things getting worse in the news, perhaps they will then change their behaviour organically. I don't know if you've got so many data points here. Have you noticed any correlation between COVID levels going up and down or anything else happening? If it's not lockdown, what else could it be?
Well, I think what we need to move away from is that any sort of black or white view of this, that this is either due to lockdown, due to vaccines, due to, people's fears. I think it is many factors influencing this, and this is why all epidemiologists really have struggled to model most other flu epidemics, etc., that they do come and go, and they do in some extent have a life of their own. And I think that's the other factor here, that, you know, it's, you know, there's the seasons, there's the cold spells, but there's also some underlying wave of the virus just coming and going in a particular time when it reaches susceptible people. So there are many, many factors here. And I think what we've really doing wrong in this country is to think it's an all or nothing thing about lockdowns. And we're absolutely right. The reason that the R value never keeps going down at the same rate is people relax because they don't see their neighbours being driven to hospital. And the opposite occurs, that when police sirens are around and, you know, their friends are dropping down, those people are going to stay indoors. And that's just normal. You know, and that's been going on for hundreds of years, that idea that when you're surrounded by danger. So I think, you know, and now at the moment, of course, we've got vaccines coming into play, which half the population are under. So the idea that you can say it's all due to this or all due to that is really crazy. And I think this is, we've overemphasized definitely the effects of government prescribed lockdowns and ignored all these other factors that are definitely as equally important, as we've seen from these, you know, at least two out of the three lockdowns, it was already on the way down before the official rules came into play. And I think, you know, we can argue about what proportion of it, but clearly it can't have been due just to the lockdown. The other factors were already in play.
Simon Wood, in your research, you also look at COVID in Sweden, which, of course, famously never locked down in any of the COVID waves. Why do you think Sweden is relevant to understanding the British situation, given how vastly different these two countries are?
Well, I think there's a couple of things to say there. I mean, one is Sweden tends to get discarded as some sort of outlier, but really it's the only place that did the experiment and did something really, really different as a Western European country. Now, of course, it is different in many ways to the UK, but on the other hand, it's also similar in some ways, that the densities in Swedish cities are not that different to the densities in UK cities. They do have large immigrant populations and so on. So I think the thing about Sweden is simply that, you know, there are things there that are very, very puzzling. If what you require is complete prescriptive lockdown in order to bring the epidemic under control, it's puzzling that the catastrophe widely predicted in Sweden simply never happened. That if you take the same models that predicted, you know, really bad outcomes in the UK, they predicted also extremely bad outcomes for Sweden, and those things didn't materialise under the Swedish policy. So I think there are some questions to answer there. Now, you can't simply say, you know, what they did in Sweden can translate easily to the UK. There are big differences, and they will be part of the difference. But I think you also can't ignore what happened in Sweden.
Tim Spector, what do you think about the Swedish example? I mean, obviously, it's strange to compare any two countries in this epidemic right now. But if it were, going back to your point about how the potency of government lockdown measures or NPIs, non-pharmaceutical interventions, if they're overstated, then does, for example, Sweden tell us that the power of people's changing behaviour is the deciding factor? It might have been over there.
Absolutely. And I've got Swedish colleagues, you know, telling me what was happening on the ground. And we do have about 80,000 people from Sweden logging, also telling us what's going on the Zoe app. So what we were seeing there is really similar patterns of behaviour, but not restricted by rules or regulations. People would just react normally when they're, you know, they were told the infection levels are high or low, and they would act appropriately. And that's probably why we saw no great difference to what was happening here, or actually, you know, slightly less. But it is slightly less dense country, so I think there's more rural elements to it. But even in place like Stockholm, I think it was the natural reactions of individuals to space themselves out and not have meetings, you know, given warnings without necessarily backed up by legal force and fines, etc. So people were just being sensible, I think, in a way that hasn't really been talked about in this country.
Right, so does that make you think that the same system might have worked here, that people might have used common sense, or folksvett, as they call it in Sweden, that the common sense and people's behaviour might have had the same success in driving the pandemic down as in Sweden? Because as you say, in Sweden, the first wave and the second wave seem to almost mirror the experience of Britain, despite very, very different policy responses.
I think that's true in general. I mean, I think there are going to be exceptions in some areas. You know, we do have some perhaps denser, more deprived areas of this country compared to Sweden, where it might have been difficult to control things. But I think it's all about giving people the information locally and making them feel they had they were in control of it. And I don't think that really happened in this country. I don't think the dissemination of what the real risks were to people at different times was there. It was a general, you know, constant fear that didn't really allow flexibility in that system. And I think perhaps the Swedes were more in touch with their health authorities in terms of getting that information out to people. Plus, you know, there's some evidence that, you know, they have a higher level of higher education as well, so also might have been able to more easily understand that information.
Right. Now, Professor Woods, you referred earlier to models that showed that Sweden would face a catastrophe that didn't lock down, disproven models. That, I don't know if you're referring to the Imperial College modelling, but certainly there was a paper from Imperial that came out in December that made a very striking claim that Britain, as we all know, was about a week, 10 days later than the rest of Europe to lock down the first time around. Now, Imperial College's studies suggest that that delay led to extra 20,000 deaths, avoidable COVID deaths in Britain, because under its modelling, the number of infections rose exponentially right up to lockdown on 23rd of March, and then it collapsed instantly. That was the model given lots of publicity. Now, you've looked at that model, and tell me what you make of it.
Well, so there's a couple of things to say there. Actually, perhaps before mentioning the model, I should say that there's also the really interesting results that come out from the REACT2 study on what happened around the first lockdown. Mm. And REACT2 is a really proper statistical sample where you take a representative sample of people and you're testing them for antibodies to COVID. And then with the people who tested positive, they then ask them about when their symptoms had started. And from that, you can also do a reconstruction of what was happening, including at the first lockdown, which, of course, you can't do with the ONS server.
So the REACT2 study is an attempt to do what you did, to reconstruct what happened just before lockdown 1 and lockdown 2. And what does the REACT2 study show us?
Well, so they've reconstructed when people will be coming infected. So the first day of infection over the course of, well, basically up until now, from right at the beginning on this basis. And that study shows a very similar pattern to what I got from the death data, that once you allow for the time from infection to first onset of symptoms, then what appears to be happening is, again, that infections are dropping before lockdown. Now, that, of course, is that contradicts what the Imperial study says.
Right. So Tim Spector, then, finally, we've got the REACT2 study, the ONS data, we've got the ZOE study from your app. All of these, is it the case that all of these suggest that COVID infections were falling before lockdown? And if so, does that mean that the whole premise of the political conversation, that every day until lockdown was a day of surging infections, might be based on a false premise?
I think so, when put in those black and white terms, yes. I mean, I think it's all a question of whether you think the only message is the lockdown, yes or no, rather than giving people, you know, the individual warnings and risks to behave appropriately. And I think that's what's been underestimated. And that's also, you know, why the Imperial modelling got it so wrong, is they just totally didn't factor in individual change as bodies were appearing and ambulances all over the place, which is natural human behaviour. They just assumed it was, you know, no change at all until that person died or got COVID. And that's completely ridiculous. So I think, yes, looking retrospectively, you know, my view is that the lockdown was not the key event, But it doesn't, not to say that lockdowns didn't help somewhat in reducing the peak of the scale of the problem or it continuing longer, but definitely all the analyses point that, you know, we'd pass that point when they were initiated.
Right. So as we've seen, you know, lots of data now, are you aware of any data, Tim Spector, that suggests the cases were rising at the point of lockdown?
No good data that I'm aware of, no.
Tim Spector and Simon Wood, thanks very much for joining me on Spectator TV. Now, a reminder about The Spectator's new app. It's out a few days ago. It contains the magazine, our podcasts, all of our blogs. We're offering it free of charge for a 3-month trial period. So if anybody wants to try out that app, it's on the iTunes store. It's also on Android. Go to spectator.co.uk/TV offer and see if you like the magazine and if you like the new app. Let us know if you don't. The email is theeditor@spectator.co.uk. Next, onto COVID in India. The situation there is getting far worse. And although India is the world's largest producer of the AstraZeneca vaccine, its factory there is running into big problems, which raises an interesting question. Britain right now is sending ventilators to India, but should we be sending vaccines as well? I'm joined by Adam Ritchie from Oxford University's Jenner Institute. He helped advise on the production of AstraZeneca vaccines here in Britain and in India. So, Adam, what do you think is going wrong in the production factories in India? Why are they encountering these difficulties which we seem not to have hit in Britain?
So, I mean, I can't speak for the Serum Institute being an employer of the University of Oxford and really speaking here in my own capacity. But what we have seen is, one, they are the biggest vaccine manufacturer. They are making the bulk of the AstraZeneca vaccine, and vaccine from the Serum Institute of India has gone to dozens and dozens of countries all over the world. So they've done a phenomenal job. You know, they've been pushing so hard to scale up. One of the unreported or underreported tragedies of the COVID pandemic has been as they were expanding their facilities, there was an electrical accident and several young men working there on the electronics for expanding their building unfortunately passed away. So they've done a phenomenal job. What we have when it comes to vaccine manufacturing is a very complicated process that has very complex supply chains. You know, dozens, hundreds really of different materials go into manufacturing these vaccines. As I say, it is very complicated. And if you run out of any of those, you run into a problem of not being able to make the vaccine. It's no good having 99% of the ingredients. If you're missing that 1%, nothing will happen. There are big global supply chains that feed it. We've seen people from the Serum Institute of India asking the US government to make sure that they're able to get the materials they need to make the AstraZeneca vaccine there at the Serum Institute. There was a little bit of a delay on that, but there's been announcements in the last few days from the White House that they're going to look to how they can release those items so that Serum Institute can keep scaling up and keep producing it at high levels. But across all the vaccine platforms, we have seen some bottlenecks around different materials, whether it's consumables, media, buffers, or things like the bioreactor bags that the vaccines are growing in. There are some shortages, and getting those solved is one of the most important things for ensuring ongoing supply.
Are these global shortages that will affect the way that we make our AstraZeneca vaccines here in Britain, or is it something which is specific to India?
So they can be. There is a broad global shortages issue. Obviously, different governments talk to each other in different ways. So,
in what sort of things? Can you give us an example of what there's a shortage of right now?
Well, what there has been a shortage of reporting in a couple of places is some of the bioreactor growth bags that are used in different vaccines. You know, one of the issues is supply, and supply chains do tend to be global for this because they're not something that's easy to manufacture. And the reason for that is because, as I hope everyone would understand and want to happen, any material that goes into manufacturing a vaccine, anything that touches it, has to be fully traceable, has to meet these very high regulatory standards. You can't just use any old bag to grow the cells in that make the vaccine. They have to be, all the plastic has to be traceable. So they're expensive, they're more difficult to make because all the materials have to be fully traceable supply chain. And so it's quite you know, the places that can manufacture those, much like the places that make the vaccine itself. They are limited globally. It's not every town doesn't have its own factory making these bags. So it does tend to be a few places around the world making them. And so there are issues when one of them runs out of the materials they need to make the bags or whatever other item it is they're making for the vaccine.
And if there are shortages, do we end up with the situation that we've seen with the vaccine purchase more generally, that perhaps that the countries that negotiated the best contracts, they make sure their supplies are coming in because they've perhaps got it written into their contract that you absolutely have to give it to us? We've seen the EU, they failed to get that kind of stipulation. It was the best efforts only. That's why the EU is lagging here. Could it be the case that the nature of the contracts that India has signed with the vaccine manufacturers have left it more exposed than, for example, we might be in this country with our relationship with what you say is only a handful of global suppliers for the vaccine components?
I don't know that's true. It's possible, but I'd be surprised if that's the explanation. To me, the most likely explanations around supply chains are primarily that there's not enough for what everyone wants, so we have an issue. I think the most likely cause for one country getting it over another is whether they have the supply chain internally. You know, so if your country's making the bioreactor bags and you put an export block on them, it's quite easy to keep them in the country.
And what's the situation in Britain, can I ask? I mean, do we import our bioreactor bags?
We probably import most of them.
And we're not facing shortages, though. I can't quite work out why we aren't affected by the same thing as India is.
So if you look at the Serum Institute of India, they're producing phenomenal, you know, I mean, the manufacturers here are producing fantastic amounts, but the Serum Institute of India is on another scale. They have a much bigger facility, many more bioreactors running, so they require more components more often because they produce more.
Right. Now, isn't there a difficult moral question coming up right now? We in this country are offering vaccines to people who have already had the virus. Therefore, the extra protection they're likely to get from a vaccine is minimal, if it exists at all. Whereas, so the vaccine, which could be marginal for one of the many people in Britain who've had COVID, could be a matter of life and death for a pensioner in India. So does this not raise ethical questions about our obligation to India and whether we might be able to perhaps say to this country, look, if you've had the virus, you don't need to come forward for the vaccine, and we can see if we can send a little more supplies to the Indian people who are literally dying for the lack of vaccines?
And look, I think obviously there isn't an ethical question there. There's a big difference between, you know, what is legally allowed and what contracts say you can and can't do. You know, if the UK has doses, they are the UK's doses. The ethical question then of what happens to those doses and how they're most effectively used is a big one. And of course, the World Health Organization, the COVAX facility that they're a big part of with UNICEF and Gates and various others, you know, one of their big goals is to try and deal with that, to try and almost get a pool of vaccines that can be distributed based on need rather than ability to pay. Now, there is that ethical question there. I'd love to say that I think humans are very good at being rational about these things and going, yes, we will share our resources and those things, but I haven't seen it happen with many other things. There's some of it happening here, but not as much as we'd like. So there is an imperative to go. If we've had enough vaccines, if our high-risk groups are vaccinated, then maybe, yes, vaccine doses should be going to India. Or, you know, 3 months from now, what's happening in India may be happening somewhere else in the world, sort of thing. So preparing for that. For those of us here at Oxford who are involved in the setting up the manufacturing process and working with AstraZeneca and others on that, this was always a big problem we saw coming. The best way we thought to deal with that was this sort of distributed manufacturing. That's why, you know, there's over a dozen countries now, or about a dozen countries, that are manufacturing the AstraZeneca vaccine. That way you have different vaccine supply chains in different places. So if one, you know, if one didn't work, that can impact that area a bit more. But what it does hopefully mean is that, you know, all the doses don't just go to the UK, the EU, and the US and other wealthy countries that can just afford to pay the manufacturer the most.
Right, so you're saying that right at the start of this, then you and your team envisaged the scenario, hardly hard to envisage, where we would vaccinate all of our at-risk groups, and then there'd be questions as to whether there'd be other poorer countries who would need it to save lives, whereas we might be pursuing it to For slightly different reasons, put it that way.
So what I'd say is we thought at the start, you know, what the most important thing in our driver is always getting vaccine into people's arms. That's, you know, how many lives can you save? How can you open up society again by getting vaccines to people? And one of the things we did see was the potential that countries where vaccines are being manufactured would hold on to those vaccines, use them in very low-risk groups, or even hold on to them just in case they're needed, rather than them being fairly distributed. You know, what we've done hasn't made it perfectly fairly distributed, but it's worth noting that the AstraZeneca vaccine is forming the backbone, and most of the doses that have gone out through COVAX have been that vaccine, and the bulk of them produced at Serum Institute and a few other sites around the world.
Right. But are we not close to that scenario now? I mean, please correct me if I've got this wrong, but somebody who has had COVID is as pretty much a young person who's had COVID is as low risk as you can probably get right now. And yet these people are being offered vaccines in Britain where that vaccine could save a life of an Indian pensioner.
Yeah. And that's that where that moral question sits. The question is how happy are the electors or the people of the UK for that to happen, and you'll hear different views on that and different ethical standpoints. That some people feel we need to protect people here the most since we have the vaccines. Others would like to see them shared more equally globally, and it depends on where you sort of see the ethics of that situation. There are of course all sorts of points here around why two doses, what's the difference between a vaccine dose and natural infection. It may very well be that having a vaccine offers longer protection than natural infection, and it may very well be that having two doses of the vaccine offers prolonged protection over multiple years, which will be quite important. For instance, it would not be overly useful or would be not a great thing if the first doses of the vaccine gave us good immunity for a period, but then if we didn't take the second dose, that immunity waned off so that suddenly we needed another two doses a year from now or something like that. These are things that the data is starting to tell us about. How long is the immunity? How long lasting? What's it made up of? Antibodies, T cells, different parts of the immune system. So there are still some questions there to answer. But broadly, if you're asking me personally, do I think we should be sending some vaccines overseas to places where they'd have more impact? My view on that would be yes. The Jenner Institute primarily works on diseases that of the developing world, of low and middle income countries. Diseases like malaria and Ebola and things like that, rabies. And so, you know, we're always looking to roll out vaccines that can save the most lives, no matter where those lives are.
Is it the case that Britain originally just envisaged getting vaccines to cover the at-risk population? I seem to remember Kate Bingham talking in those terms right at the start of the programme.
You'd have to ask Kate and the ministers about exactly what their thinking was. The plan at our end was always just, because once you're making it, you can keep making it. The plan at our end was just to make as much vaccine as we can in as diverse a bunch of geographical locations as we could. And whether those doses were going to be for the UK or for somewhere else, that wasn't our primary driver. Our primary driver was what is going to let us have the most doses of vaccine and then hope that they end up with the right people in the right time frame.
Adam, thanks very much for joining us on Spectator TV. Now on to cyber warfare. British troops are going to be joining their Ukrainian counterparts in the next few weeks to prepare for operations gaming what they would do if Russia escalated the aggression over there. Now, Vladimir Putin said last week that any response by Russia would be asymmetrical. In other words, he might have other tricks up his sleeve. Now, might those tricks include cyber warfare? We've known for some time that Russia has quite sophisticated hacking capabilities, as does China, as does North Korea. So what might we be experiencing them next time something heats off in the battlefield far away? Professor Noel Sharkey, who's at the University of Sheffield, will be known to many of you as a judge on robot wars. He's written a feature saying we should be very concerned indeed about the capabilities of our potential adversary. He joins me now, along with Sir Richard Dearlove, who used to be head of MI6. So, Professor Sharkey, let's start with you. We've known about cyber warfare for a very long time. Why should we be any more concerned now than we were, 10, 15 years ago?
Well, quite a lot has happened, in fact. I mean, we know about, for instance, ransomware attacks on our hospitals, on our schools. Those are all hacks. But also, it's increasing dramatically. There's a lot of cyber espionage into our industry, for instance, massively. People are repelling hits all the time. And we really need to do something more than we are. We need to educate the public more about password security, for instance, because we're pretty insecure, I would say, generally in the civilian world.
Right, but is that strategic? I mean, for example, if things were to heat up in Ukraine, is there any serious risk that Putin or forces sympathetic to Putin might switch the lights off in Aberdeen or something like that?
They could do. They've demonstrated that kind of capability. We now have according to the new Defence Review, we're developing cyber warriors or cyber force, but that's not going to protect civilians so much. We don't have, one of the problems I have is we don't really have contingency plans, and the ransomware attacks have demonstrated this really clearly to me, where ambulances are knocked out and hospital records and we can't access patients. And it's possible as well, because we use so many Internet of Things devices, and by that I mean the likes of Alexa or even internet toothbrushes or, you know, trivial things really. Our heating systems, for instance, use these Nest controllers that are controlled by the internet. Those are all very hackable. And what you can do is, once you can get in there, because people don't change the password, and also passwords are being stolen and sold large scale on the dark web and things like Joker Bazaar. So we have all these insecure devices. And once you get into one of these devices, you can use that, recruit many more. And then you have this idea of a DDoS attack, distributed denial of services attack, that brought Netflix, The Guardian, Twitter down last year. And so how can we stop this? And having a cyber force in charge of our security is insufficient. What we really need is a national program of education about how our, you know, my toothbrush, I don't have an internet toothbrush because I think it's ridiculous, but my internet toothbrush, if I had one, could cause real problems for security in this country generally.
Now, Sir Richard, I won't ask if you've got an internet toothbrush, but you were not a great fan of Huawei's being involved in British infrastructure. But what I can't work out then and now is, surely MI6, GCHQ, the British security services are one step ahead of Russia, of China. Surely our defences are equal to any attack which our far smaller, more poorer adversaries might have up their sleeve.
Well, I'm not sure that that's true. I mean, the problem that we have in the UK or any advanced liberal democracy is, as Professor Shark has already emphasized, is that we don't have sufficient ability to control the civilian infrastructure. Some critical infrastructure is well protected, but there are so many gaps and vulnerabilities in a free society. And I mean, what you have to bear in mind is, if you take the Chinese have built their own systems in a way which is quite different from how we, you know, conceive our own infrastructure. And the fusion between civilian, military and academic life in China is now very sophisticated. So a company like Huawei has massive degree of contact with the Chinese military. And the Chinese military is closely integrated into all Chinese major universities. So they have learned very fast, and they've built themselves a defensive and offensive cyber capability. And they've learned from their mistakes very, very quickly. There's a concept in SIGINT or collection, which is called shaping the environment, i.e. building architecture which is favorable to your strategic objectives. For us to do that in the West is possible, but very complex and very difficult. But for the Chinese to do that is, they have developed a very sophisticated infrastructure. So if you take Huawei and ZTE, the main telecommunications companies, we are, if we use their equipment, we become vulnerable to the sophistication of their architecture. I think that's the best way that I can explain it. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked by the naivety of the government in their attitude towards Huawei becoming involved in our 5G mm-hmm. systems or being so deeply embedded in them. And I'm absolutely delighted that the decision eventually has been taken to exclude them. You know, we will over time, I mean, it's not a simple issue, you can't just close the door, but we will reduce our vulnerabilities undoubtedly.
Mm-hmm. So Richard, when you were learning your spycraft, it was relatively straightforward. You knew who the bad guys were, you knew if they were doing something bad and where. But now, when you try to trace the origin of cyber attacks, I remember a few years ago, one of them, which was regarded as a North Korean cyber attack, was traced to an internet cafe in Brighton. Now, almost certainly it wasn't organised from there, but it's very easy to disguise your origins, very difficult to retaliate if you can't be completely sure where the attack came from in the first place. So surely the asymmetricality that Putin refers to is not simply the fact that he might have capabilities that we lack, but he would be able to use methods of concealing that would make it very difficult for us to work out who we even direct our return of fire to.
Well, I think attribution is a significant problem, but I mean, when this problem, you know, let's say over time accumulated a significant profile, I think some of the early cyber attacks, the tradecraft behind them was reasonably poor and attribution was more straightforward and easier. But the Chinese, as it were, learned a lot, let's say, from Snowden's revelations about what, you know, the West's capability was. And in fact, they've much upped their game. They're much more sophisticated now. And there are ways that you can, as it were, divert your attack to other people's servers. And obviously the internet cafe in Brighton is a typical example. There's no way the attack came from there. And you know, you remember that we have this capability ourselves. And, you know, it is an important way of collecting intelligence on strategic targets. But when you look at the way that the Chinese have upped their games, you have to up your defensive sophistication to keep abreast of the problem. And I mean, in a way, it is a type of arms race. And I think one of the problems is that there is very little international agreement at the moment to, as it were, prevent this constant escalation. I mean, Obama did a deal with Xi Jinping briefly, which was signed, I think, in Seattle during that famous visit. But, you know, whether the Chinese have respected that is an open question. Whether the Americans have respected it is an open question. And at the moment, you know, we're upping the game, we're upping the sophistication. And I think one of the problems that we've got in the West, that we don't have the sort of authoritarian control of resources to match the massive effort that the Chinese are putting into this. I mean, the third and fourth People's Liberation Armies are largely devoted entirely to this cipher issue and China's cipher capability. But there's one important thing to remember about this is, you know, why do the Chinese want to shape you know, their environment, their electronic environment? It's actually not us they're worrying about, it's their own population. So the primary objective of China's cyber capability is control within their own country. And their offensive capability is an extension of that control.
Right. So, Professor Sharkey, that's the problem, isn't it? There's simply asymmetricality of rules of engagement, and they simply will do things which we wouldn't do for moral, ethical, or legal reasons. So, no matter how good our technology might be, we'd never properly be able to deploy it or defend it simply because they're using piracy rules and we're not pirates.
Well, I wouldn't like to take the moral high ground too much here, to be honest. And I think Sir Richard could testify to that, though I doubt he will. It's not a matter of that. And the problem with attribution that you bring up is so important because there's no reason why Taiwan, for instance, couldn't make it look as if it was a Chinese attack. Now, I was at a conference with very senior people from the US military, including their cyber division. And the idea there was that maybe we don't need absolute proof. Maybe we can just use suspicion of particular circumstances, and then that would unleash a kinetic attack. Now, the worry is that when Russia are threatening and talking about asymmetry, supposing China was now to attack us, if we did something in Ukraine and China decided to attack us under the cloak of Russia, we would think it was Russia. And that is this. It's just getting out of hand. And one of the big problems is, as Sir Richard just said, was a complete lack of international regulation. I mean, Antony Guterres at the UN 2 years ago brought this up and said we really desperately, urgently need new regulation. But nobody's taking it up. And I would like Britain to step up, really, and push on this because we're not that strong and we need to be pushing on it. And you know, the International Committee of the Red Cross, who look after the Geneva Conventions, etc., say that there are laws that the laws of war, IHL, and IHL dictates that you cannot attack civilians. You must discriminate in an armed conflict. Now, IHL only applies to armed conflict. What if it's not an armed conflict? We don't have international regulations for that. Whether or not you think people will obey them, that's not the matter. We have speed limit on our road, and most people break it, but it's a bit of elastic that kind of holds us back from going too far.
Okay. Sir Richard, one final question to you. We've seen recently that the MI5 is being involved in a leak inquiry, apparently. What do you think of this? The intelligence agency is being brought back to find out which special advisor briefed what to the press. This typically hasn't been the job of our intelligence agencies.
Well, I mean, leak inquiries have a sort of very varied history in the UK. I mean, in a way, it's quite sensible perhaps to use the resources of MI5 if it's politically important and, you know, one needs to pin something down. I'm not quite sure what the drift of your question is.
Well, I'm just wondering, in your day, I bet you'd be quite surprised if somebody picked up the phone from number 10 saying, look, we reckon somebody briefed it to the press. Would you guys in MI6 please kindly tell us who did it? I mean, you wouldn't have got...
Well, MI6 definitely doesn't do that sort of thing. I mean, you know, we are an offensive intelligence agency. But, in the past, retired senior MI6 officers has been used for leak inquiries. I don't see anything particularly surprising about that. I mean, they're usually driven out of the Cabinet Office leak inquiries. And I think even when the resources of MI6 haven't been publicly announced as being used, they're possibly using a couple of MI5 officers to help, who are, you know, professional investigators, therefore know what they're doing. But there's one important point that we've left out of this discussion about attribution. And of course, it's the importance still of human source intelligence. Because if you want to be clear about what the Chinese are doing and you can't work it out through technical attribution, if you have a source buried in the right place, you know, in the right bit of the People's Liberation Army, you can get most of these questions answered. And of course, that's one of the reasons why Snowden was so damaging, because he did, as a human source, betray both to the Russians and to the Chinese, you know, massive areas of American and actually British capability in the areas of SIGINT. We are to an extent fortunate in the UK because of our sophistication and the depth of expertise that rests at GCHQ, but it's a fantastic asset which is being diminished in value for the reasons that we've explained a little bit in this discussion.
Right, so Richard, you're basically saying we can get somebody on the inside in the People's Liberation Army or in North Korea, and they can just basically tell us who did what.
So that's one of the ways of understanding what the capability is being aimed at us. It's a combination of your technical knowledge and your human coverage. If you can put the two together, you get a reasonably complete picture.
Richard and Noel, thank you very much indeed for joining me. Now, that's it for this week on Spectator TV. I'd like again to thank our sponsor, Charles Stanley, one of the oldest firms on the London Stock Exchange and one of Britain's leading wealth management companies. Now, if you'd like to give some feedback on Spectator TV, we're always very pleased to receive it. You can also like or subscribe to the channel if you want to hear from us again, which I would hope you do. Thanks for watching, and thanks very much to Max Jeffrey, our producer.